I have to go upstairs and record something again, so...
Quiet.
Do not...
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
You're listening to Pandemic, a podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Colm O'Mungine, and each week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. Sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat. The correspondents and I will be recording this in many cases on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Thursday, July 13th, and as we record this in the evening, global cases of coronavirus now stand at 20.7 million. Deaths have exceeded 750,000. That's over 1 million more cases and over 40,000 people who have died since we recorded our last episode on this day last week. Here in Ireland, the Department of Health has confirmed that there have been 92 more cases of COVID-19 in the last 24 hours and no new deaths. So that brings the total number of cases here to 26,929. The number of coronavirus-related deaths remains at 1,744. Six people died here with COVID-19 since we recorded that last episode. In a statement, the National Public Health Emergency Team says 72% of the new cases are under the age of 45. More on that later. Coming up in this episode, we'll be talking to journalist and author Anshul Pfeffer about a rocky couple of months in Israel, where a second surge of cases has been seen. We'll also be getting an update from the COVID Response Committee in Leinster House, where the meat industry, unions and the Health and Safety Authority were discussing the outbreak that has resulted in me getting better acquainted with the environs of Kildare, where I record this podcast. So listener, greetings from the epicentre. First today, our health correspondent Fergal Bowers, who we haven't had on the pod in a while. All right, Fergal, how are you?
I'm good. I've had a break for a few weeks, staycation, mostly in Dublin. The weather wasn't super, but just everyone's had to experience whatever they've had to experience. Some nicer breaks I see for people who've had around the country. There's some nice weather in different parts of the country. It's an unusual 2020. I think my favourite social media laughter point, I suppose, in the last few days was someone said, I don't like series one of 2020. When is season two starting? So
yeah, well, I feel from the middle of Kildare, Fergal, I'm already in season two. And I think if that person is a listener, they're going to be wildly disappointed. My personal favourite was the Lion King meme that's going around, where Simba and Mufasa are standing staring off into the distance. And they say that dark bit, that's Kildare, we don't go there. Or the alternative of Steve McQueen as Virgil Hiltz in The Great Escape, sitting there on his motorbike beside the barbed wire saying, I hear there's a back road to Confi open. So... there you go. That's what it comes for in dark humour when you're on the travel restrictions in Kildare, as I am, or Laois, or indeed Offaly. So, Fergal, I suppose that brings us kind of neatly to where we are at the moment. We were getting increasingly optimistic as time went on the last time I spoke to you, which is quite a while ago at this stage. How did we get to where we are now, and what's the particular point of concern amongst the experts as to what way the country is going?
Well, as you know, we saw the very first confirmed case here at the end of February. I suppose we're 5.5 months in now in the health emergency here in Ireland, and the overall figures here in the Republic of Ireland are 26,838 confirmed cases here, and sadly we've seen 1,774 deaths. The figures just a short time ago in from Northern Ireland show 8 new cases today of coronavirus, so they've had 6,225 in total. No further deaths, thankfully, and so their official death toll remains at 557 cases. So that's where things stand at this point.
Why was it a particular point of concern, Fergal, do you know, when, and this is the question a lot of people are asking, if this is an outbreak in the meat plants and community transmission is not high, why lock down entire counties?
Yes, I mean, look, there has been criticism about whole counties being shut down, but the acting chief medical officer, Dr. Ronan Glynn, you know, he's emphasised it's not the case that all of the recent cases relating to lockdown in the three counties are in areas near the meat factories. And the point the health experts are saying is that Cases have been located throughout counties affected because people live in and they socialise across counties. So cases have been seen, you know, in Birr, Clara, Forban, Edenderry, Tullamore, Maynooth, Newbridge, Clane, Athy, Durrow, Abbey Leaks. And that's because people are travelling across the borders of counties into other workplaces and for other reasons unrelated to factories. So that's the explanation they have.
Right. I suppose people might well ask as well, well then why not lock down East Galway or indeed any of the other counties neighbouring Kildare for that matter? But anyway, it's been limited to three counties. Presumably they're going to take the pulse of that and see what way the numbers have gone. So what way does it look, Fergal, in terms of the other numbers? I mean, how has all of this affected our R rating, first of all? And the other key indicator that we've been looking at all along in this is the numbers in hospitals and the people in serious condition in hospitals in critical care.
Well, in terms of the R number, I mean, there's good news there, although it's quite difficult to estimate it. But the latest estimate of the R numbers, which is the average number of people one infected person will infect, is it's at 1.6 now.
Okay.
And that's down,
so down from
1.8.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
From last week. So, look, but again, the numbers, you do kind of need fairly large numbers, and there are a lot of factors that go into it. And but that's their best estimate of it. But you'd always look to see what's happening in hospitals to determine, you know, the seriousness of cases, because admissions to hospital are the thing you'd watch. Now, on average, one person is being admitted to hospital each day as a suspected or confirmed case. That's quite low. And the figures today from the HSE show that there are 11 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in hospital. Six of these are in intensive care units. There are 137 suspected cases in hospitals, of which five are in ICU. And at the moment, the hospitals have 39 adult ICU beds free. So they can cope with the numbers because the numbers are manageable and
right.
The numbers in hospital are stable.
But just about anything like a big increase, because we're at a stage now where it's because of the return of relative normality. And I think the world has seen this in Israel as well. We'll be looking at that particular instance later in this podcast. But because things are going relatively back to normal, people are in intensive care units for other non-COVID reasons. So the beds we had free during the total lockdown are no longer free, and it is quite limited. We're back at a bit of a pinch point, which could be the cause for concern amongst the expert groups like NPHET.
It is if we get a second wave or a series of waves. And I suppose what people would ask is, I mean, they'd be looking to the HSE if we get a surge to see what extra capacity has been put in place over these 5 months that we've had the emergency here. So extra capacity in terms of beds, extra staffing, apart from having to reorganise the hospital system and slowly rebuild non-COVID care, how different is the health system going to be if we get a second surge? People will be looking at that quite closely.
Yeah, Professor Philip Nolan was talking about that there is no longer any excuse for the public health system to come under pressure anymore because people know what to do. He seemed to be indicating that it's up to all of society not to allow a situation arise where there would be high concern about the number of beds in hospitals or, unsustainable pressure coming on the service.
I mean, there's shared responsibility for people to follow the social distancing and other guidelines. And people are doing that. By and large, mask wearing is good. Social distancing is going pretty well. But, you know, we are in the summer. It's not surprising that there has been an increase in cases in recent weeks. I think on average over the last 5 days, about 75 cases a day. So, you know, there was a period going back a few weeks ago when we were looking at single digit cases in a day. And there had been some hope that we were looking at perhaps we'd see a day or some days with no deaths or no cases. That didn't transpire, and the figures have gone up a bit. That's because people have been travelling around the country. They've been following the staycation advice that has been put out there. They're out and about trying to enjoy days when the weather is good and, you know, trying to relax before they get back to work in whatever environment they're working in at home or under, you know, different circumstances. So it's no surprise at times that the cases have increased. I mean, I know from colleagues around the country in certain locations, there's large numbers of people on the streets. There's queues outside restaurants or pubs operating as restaurants. That's because maybe half of the places in locations are shut and half are open. open. So it's a pressure valve situation, which the restrictions have I suppose, caused to some effect. So you can expect that that's going to be the case.
What about the ages, Fergal? There was a very concerning statistic from a different country, which I was reading during the week, the city of Uppsala in Sweden, 27% of 19-year-olds tested positive for coronavirus. We hear about under 45s in Ireland being a big cohort of people who are testing positive. What's the story with that?
Well, that's true, because of the 40 cases reported yesterday, three quarters are under 45 years of age. So that tells you something. It might also be a factor, going back to my earlier point about the seriousness of cases going into hospital, it may be the factor that you're seeing, you know, relatively small numbers being admitted to hospital in serious cases, because it tends to be, but not exclusively, tends to be that younger people don't display, you know, serious symptoms, and indeed some may not be aware that they're infected at all.
And finally then, Fergal, before we go, we're in the month of August now. People are looking ahead to the schools reopening. What's the state of play with the expert view on how the coronavirus might be transmitted within the school? Are people still reasonably confident that younger people, the risk can't be eliminated, but that it's of a much lower order than elsewhere in society?
Well, parents are concerned about schools reopening. And the official position is that school children tend to, you know, they get a mild version of the virus, and a lot of them don't display any symptoms. I think the greater concern, and this has yet to play out properly, is a concern that school children might, when they return home, perhaps spread to adults at home or older relatives. There was a report in the New York Times there the other day I was looking at. In 2 weeks in July, there were 100,000 children in the US confirmed with COVID-19, and that's from the American Academy of Pediatrics. So there is some concern, but the World Health Organization saying this week that, you know, schools have to reopen. Children do need their education. Nothing is risk-free, and that point repeated by Dr. Ronan Glynn, the chief medical officer here, the other day too, so that they'll monitor it. It's highly likely, I think the view is, that some schools will close if there's an outbreak, but that over time, a way will be found to manage these things, and maybe in a more nuanced or targeted way. But they do have to reopen, schooling has to return. In one sense, it seems we're going to be living with this virus. Ireland hasn't decided to go down the route of a zero COVID strategy, which has been discussed and, you know, promoted by a number of experts here and in other countries, where you do strong measures to eliminate the virus completely from the country. So you wouldn't relax restrictions at any point, but you'd get to a point, from an all-Ireland perspective, where you'd have no virus in the country. You'd have to control now arrivals and have an aggressive policy on testing and isolating travellers coming into the country. But you would get to a stage where the whole country could reopen and the economy could return if you eliminated the virus. I just don't see that that's the policy that's being adopted here, for a variety of reasons.
Right. Will you be crossing a county boundary anytime soon, Fergal?
I won't, and I already know that people are, would you believe, some people are have started, God forbid to mention it at this stage, it's August, some of their Christmas shopping to get it out of the way, and, wondering, might Santa be locked down this year? If Rudolph is a red nose, will he be allowed out too? We'll be looking at these things in the months ahead.
I'll be having a vaccine at the top of the Christmas letters out of this house this year. All right, Fergal, thanks a million. Right. Thanks for talking.
Take care.
Now, as I mentioned at the outset, restrictions on travel have been reimposed in counties Laois, Offaly and Kildare. The reason? COVID outbreaks in meat production facilities and in some direct provision centres where factory staff were living. That's what was under discussion today at the COVID Response Committee in the Dáil Chamber in Leinster House, and RTÉ political reporter Mary Regan was keeping track of it. Hiya Mary, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad. I hear a bit of background noise there. You're in our busy political bureau, having monitored the COVID committee today.
Yes, we're watching the COVID committee, this special sitting really that's convened as a result of what we learned last week in terms of new processing plants and the severe restrictions in the three counties, which I'm sure you yourself are all too aware of.
I am indeed. I'm sitting here in the middle of County Kildare, where there are a number of meat processing plants and pet food plants and the like, Mary, and cool camp cancelled for next week for the children. Plenty of matches cancelled, so a house full of disappointed children, but on the upside, less diesel being burnt in the car.
Good, good.
Right, so what was going on at the COVID committee today? We'll start bread and butter issues, or should I say price of beef issues, was one thing that struck you.
Yeah, this is a really interesting sort of side issue, I guess, to this entire story about trying to contain the spread of COVID from meat plants and the contain the spread of community transmissions as a result, because as the government announced earlier this week now, all workers in all meat processing plants are going to be tested on a weekly basis for the next couple of weeks for COVID-19. That's around 6,000 workers who will be tested every week, and they were putting the question in the committee. Carol Nolan, who's a local TD in Offaly, saying, you know, how can we be sure that this isn't going to be used as an excuse, really, to, as she put it, you know, push prices that farmers get for their beef back down. Of course, you know, she said, do we want to be going back to last year, last summer? We remember all the protests and all the difficulties around the price of beef. And Cormac Healy, who's the representative there from the Meat Industry Ireland, he said that if the turnaround time for tests isn't quick, you know, if they can't be done in the space of 24 hours, that, you know, would lead to a disruption for the production lines. It would mean markets won't be supplied. And he said this, of course, would impact prices. So a likely scenario there could be a drop in the prices that farmers are getting on the one hand and an increase for consumers on the other. But they're saying, of course, they're hoping that scenario can be avoided if the tests can be carried out in 24 hours.
Right. It's also a neat way of applying pressure to the authorities to turn around those tests quickly if angry farmers are the prospect on the outside. There was a couple of other issues, Mary. Let's have a look at the area of inspections first. There was some surprise at the proportion of inspections that were unannounced when it comes to monitoring something like COVID-19. Inspectors aren't just turning up, or if they are, it's in a minority of cases.
Yeah, so the Health and Safety Authority said that there have been 39 inspections carried out at meat processing plants since March. Now, of those 39, 30 were pre-notified to management and 9 were unannounced inspections. So, you know, there was a lot of criticism, particularly from Sinn Féin, saying, you know, it was unacceptable that management in factories were getting notice of inspections being carried out. SIPTU said, you know, this is sort of similar to someone coming to visit your house, a visitor, and you're getting the kitchen tidied and the food ready. So, you know, they're saying that they really do believe that there should be more unannounced inspections. But Jennifer Carol McNeil from Fine Gael was asking the question, really, what kind of notice do they get for inspections? And, you know, the answer that she got from the Health and Safety Authority was, well, you know, we tend to contact them the night before, or in some cases the morning of. So the Health and Safety Authority is saying, yes, there are cases where we do give notice, but in these cases the notice isn't that long.
Right. I suppose the concern there being certain workers could be asked to stay away from work that day, and maybe the inspection wouldn't capture what it might capture. And there was an issue of another sort about notification raised by one of the TDs from the affected counties as well. Tell us about that notification of a different kind.
Yes, so James Lawless, the Fianna Fáil TD, was saying that he's raised this issue about a loophole, as it were, in the law that means that workplaces don't have to tell the Health and Safety Authority if there is a COVID case in their workplace. They're not obliged in any way to tell the authorities about that. Now, the health and safety at work is covered by laws that date back to 2005. And in the original law, there was an obligation that all things like accidents, illnesses or injuries and infectious diseases in workplaces are notified to the HSA. That law was changed in 2016. you know, didn't go through the Dáil or anything. It was just a ministerial order signed by a minister of state at the time. Probably few people really noticed. But of course, it took on an added meaning when the COVID outbreak stuck, because that meant that change in 2016 removed the term infectious disease from the matters that had to be notified to the authorities. So essentially now, if you fell in a factory, you tripped up, you broke your ankle, something like that happened, or if you got some sort of other illness, your workplace might have to tell the authorities. However, if you get COVID-19 or other infectious diseases, they don't have to tell the authorities. And James Lawless is questioning the legality, in fact, and he is a barrister, qualified barrister as well as a TD, questioning the legality of that particular ministerial regulation that was signed in 2016. Of course, you know, we've heard of other incidents of ministerial regulations recently in relation to the PUP payment and stopping people at airports. So they're a sort of tool used by ministers that people might not be very aware of, but, you know, certainly a number of them have risen to prominence in recent times. And James Lawless is saying, well, you're essentially changing the law, and, you know, it really should have gone back through the Dáil. And TD is also questioning why it was changed in this way. And Patricia King of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions said that this really needs to be changed. And she said that ICTU has been pushing for a change to this by way of their representation on the board of the Health and Safety Authority. But in her words, the HSA has been obstructing any attempts to change it.
Right. Now, the HSA, what did the HSA say to that? Yeah,
they were asked about this at the committee, and their response was really that they are responsible for monitoring and, you know, what happens in workplaces, and something like COVID might not necessarily be restricted to a workplace in the sense that someone could contract COVID-19 from outside their workplace, then maybe arrive in work, pass it on to someone else, then bring it outside again. So they're saying it's something like this really has to be dealt with by public health officials and not a body such as theirs, which is limited to workplaces.
All right, Mary, that's that continuing there as we record this in the middle of the afternoon. How long more is the meat industry going to be under scrutiny from the COVID response committee? Do we know?
Well, I think they should be finishing up pretty soon, and then there will be other representatives in, these are a group of scientists really, who are calling for this zero COVID policy to be adopted here, you know, similar to the New Zealand model, and that's their particular focus of the witnesses who'll be in before the committee in the afternoon.
Okay, that's great, Mary. Thanks a million. Thanks for the time.
Thanks. Bye bye.
Now to Israel. Population, nearly 9 million. COVID cases, over 89,500. Deaths, 691. Initially, the country clamped down hard on the virus and had a low incidence, but over the summer, it has surged. To look at this, I spoke to Anshul Pfeffer. He writes for Israel's Haaretz newspaper, as well as The Economist and The Sunday Times, and he's also written Bibi, a biography of Benjamin Netanyahu. We recorded this conversation on Tuesday. So how are you, buoyant after an extra time victory for Manchester United, I suppose, in the first instance?
Oh, yes. It was, we made heavy weather of it, but finally, yeah.
Did you get out to watch it elsewhere, or are restrictions such that you had to watch it in the privacy of your own home, or is that your preference anyway?
It depends. I mean, I'm quite partial to watching football down at the pub, but I'm in Jerusalem and there are not that many sports bars which would have been showing it, and there are restrictions on the number of people inside. So, you know, it's feeling rather restricted, rather suffocating to watch sports in a pub or a bar nowadays. Hopefully next season it'll be different. So I watched it in the comfort of my own home this time.
Looking at the statistics, I mean, since the middle of last month, there's been a doubling in the number of cases and almost a doubling in the number of deaths as well. I mean, Israel, which began so comprehensively with widespread travel bans and restrictions and was being held up as an exemplar of how to cope with coronavirus, how would you describe it?
Well, first of all, just to put things in context, it already seems to be at the end of its second wave. The number of infections has been going down for the last week or so, despite the fact that the number of infections spiked almost 2,000 a day, as you said, a couple of weeks ago, and it was going up for over a month. more or less from early June, it still hasn't had a relatively high number of deaths or serious cases. There hasn't been so far, as we've seen, a major rise in the death rate in Israel, or in what people are calling the excess death rate. But it's no question that Israel has been experiencing a swift and quite rapid second wave, and it's caused a lot of issues when it comes to traveling to and from Israel. Israel is now considered by most countries a red country. In other words, you can't, if you're an Israeli citizen, you can't travel abroad easily. And this has had a major adverse effect on the economy. As you said, early on, Israel was responding very quickly to the pandemic, and Israel was being held up by many in the world, the most experts and politicians, as a country which had done well at the beginning by closing its borders, by imposing social distances and a partial lockdown much earlier than many countries, and that was how Israel seemed to have minimized the first wave and get over it by May. All these things seem to have been squandered very quickly.
And how?
I think the two main things is that A, the emergence from lockdown was badly managed. It was hasty. It wasn't clear at every stage what is reopening and how it's going to reopen. And the reopening of many things seemed to be happening more due to pressure of businesses and of various groups in Israeli society, rather than a careful and well-planned program of easing the restrictions. That was the first thing. And very quickly, we saw the result of that in the numbers going up and spread and the infection spreading. And the other thing is that Israel didn't put in place an efficient contact tracing system, which would have been able to detect and severe the chains of infection quickly. Israel used a surveillance system, which was basically a counter-terrorism mobile phone surveillance system, which is probably much better at tracking a suspected attacker carrying a suicide and explosive belt, rather than tracking viruses, which is a very different kind of type of tracking and surveillance. And this system, it has its uses, but it's inefficient for facing COVID-19, was used instead of setting up a more tailor-made contact tracing system. And I think Israel is still paying the price for that, and only now very slowly beginning to set up a contact tracing apparatus.
Which might surprise people, given Israel's reputation for being a high-tech society and exports its technology all over the world.
I couldn't agree more. And two things are surprising. One, as you said, Israel's a high-tech society. It's one of the leading countries when it comes to tech innovation, has been for two decades at least. And the other thing is that Israel is used to national emergencies. Israel has fought wars and has undergone various national security emergencies, over recent decades. Israel has agencies which have recent experience in dealing with nationwide emergencies. So how has the government been so inefficient now? And I think one of the reasons is that Israel is more attuned to dealing with security related emergencies, and this is something which is, the pandemic is something which is much more civilian, of a civilian nature. I think that this has been difficult for Israel to sort of get, at least for the official agencies, to get their head around. And the other reason is political. There is Israel is in a political situation where one man wields a level of power and of control over the government structure. That's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and he has been reluctant until very recently to even appoint a coordinator, or some called it a coronavirus czar, to be in charge of nationwide reaction. Instead, he basically took management of it himself with a tiny staff of advisors reporting directly to him. And that turned out to be pretty inefficient in recent months.
Right, so he owns it now. But I mean, it was not to get too pointy-headed about it. I mean, you've written a very good biography about him, if you don't mind me plugging it.
You're welcome to mention it's out now in the UK and Ireland in a new edition, yes.
Right, in all good bookshops and online. end of plug. But how much of the Prime Minister's dealings with this, and as I say, not to get too pointy-headed about it, represents kind of two dual paths within him? On the one hand, he fancies himself as Mr. Economy. On the other hand, he fancies fancies himself as Mr. Security. And when it comes to coronavirus, sometimes there's a conflict between those two things.
Yes, you're quite right. And part of it is also due to the fact that he's very anxious that no one else will get the credit. And in the first two or three months, Israel was doing well. As we said, Israel very quickly got past the first wave with a relatively low number of deaths. And, he was very, very eager to be seen as not just as Mr. Economy and Security, but as Mr. Coronavirus, because he had beaten the pandemic, and he was calling upon Israelis to go out and have a beer and have a coffee because things are fine. And he wasn't, and it's important to say he was not a pandemic denier like some of the leaders we've seen around the world, like Donald Trump or Jair Bolsonaro. He was very early in recognizing how serious this could be. Some even on the left in the opposition accused him of being too hysterical about the virus. But he was very early in warning against it, in acting against it, in closing the borders, implementing social distancing. But he was also much too early in proclaiming his victory. I said before that this is a civilian emergency, and Israel is more attuned to fighting, is to confronting security emergencies. But at the same time, it has to be recognized that the biggest resources in Israeli government and in Israel are parked within the security establishment, within the military, within the Ministry of Defense. And it would have made sense to have used some of these resources in confronting coronavirus. It wasn't done because the Minister of Defense is a political rival of Netanyahu, who he's forced to cohabit with in government, but he doesn't want his political rival to get any of the credit. So the military and the security resources, which could have helped in many ways in preventing the second wave of coronavirus, were utilized to a very minimal degree because of these political rivalries. And I think Netanyahu would have used these resources if the ministry was not under a political rival of his. And that this is one of the things that will be counted against him when Israelis begin to assess what happened here. And we're already seeing his popularity ratings, which were high back in May, when he was seen as the man who had single-handedly saved Israel from coronavirus. Now he's being seen by many Israelis, including right-wingers who would normally support him, as the man who has dropped the ball on this.
So is coronavirus what's driving the demonstrations outside his residence and his party's headquarters?
I think that the demonstrations we're seeing now, both in Jerusalem, outside the official residence, and across Israel, is certainly fueled by the uncertainty and by the economic uncertainty, mainly people losing their jobs or being furloughed. It's certainly fueled by that, and Netanyahu is increasingly seen as the culprit. But I'd be careful from saying this is like a new wave of protests, because we've had for the last two or three years weekly protests against him, mainly regarding the corruption allegations. He's facing a trial for bribery and fraud, and that obviously the protests have grown in the last month or so, and that's been fueled by coronavirus. But I still think that it's mainly people who are opposed to him anyway. Occasionally you see people at the protest saying, "I'm a right winger. I voted for Netanyahu's party, and now I'm blaming him and I'm against him." But the people who are protesting on the streets are his opponents, who have been whose protest has been fueled by what's happening. But I think that Netanyahu's main problem is not a protest on the street. The numbers are not huge relative to Israeli population or anything, and he's not. He's not being besieged, so once a week it's outside his residence, but it's not like they're going to break down the barriers and pull him out of the residence. I think this is another symptom of him being seen by an increasing number of Israelis as responsible for what is now pretty clearly an ineffective and inept and really damaging response over the last 3 months, and this kind of responsibility is going to taint his record and will make it very difficult for him to win an election in the future, or to even claim that he has the public backing.
There have been a couple of, I suppose, more vulnerable communities within Israel. I think you had a look at one of them, the Haredi community, who, I suppose, are not naturally set up to be open to government coronavirus responses, in that high possession of smartphones isn't there for the likes of contact tracing. Yeah. and they didn't particularly want to engage in social distancing either.
We've seen this across the world. The less advantaged parts of society in every country are more vulnerable to a pandemic. You know, they live usually in more cramped conditions and have less access to public information and also some hostility to the governments telling them what to do and how to change their lives. And I think all these things are very much part of the Orthodox community's way of life. And this is what we're seeing, and we're talking about a community which is maybe 10% or 12% at the most of Israeli society. And yet there have been at some points between two-thirds and three-quarters of the numbers of those infected. So this has certainly been a major part of how coronavirus has impacted in Israel. And at the same time, this community, even though it's disadvantaged and it's poor, has quite strong political representation because they're staunch allies of Netanyahu. So that's allowed them to kind of have their own autonomy, and the government is very reluctant to interfere with them. And this has actually worked against that community because the government hasn't tried, and certainly in various stages of the pandemic, hasn't really tried to enforce the restrictions on them or has been slow in doing so. And this is certainly one of the causes for the higher incidence of cases amongst this community.
Finally then, I suppose you could say that this government was partially put together, the coalition that's currently in charge of Israel, in what seemed to be unlikely during the election campaign. It was put together under the pressure of COVID-19. Could it fall apart, and could we be looking at another election in Israel as a result of the pressures brought to bear by COVID-19 as well?
Well, we could be looking at another election as a result of the pressures being brought on the man at the top of the government. And Netanyahu is facing a resumption of his trial in January, when the evidence will begin to be heard at the district court in Jerusalem, and it's something that he knows will create even more pressure for him to step down, which is why he will probably try and somehow provoke another election in the next few months, in the hope that maybe this time he'll get a majority necessary to pass legislation which would shield him from the trial. You know, as you know, Israel had three elections in the last year and a bit. And in none of them, Netanyahu managed to win that majority he needs. And now his government is sort of a cohabitation between him and the centrist Blue and White Party, which is very, very uncomfortable. He'd love to get out of this. It's not a happy government or happy coalition. But I think because of COVID, because of the pandemic, it'll be very difficult for him to convince his normally quite pliant political allies to join him in a move for another election, because everyone is obviously doesn't think that Israel should have a fourth election in the space of just 20 months, certainly when the country is facing this massive economic crisis due to COVID.
All right. Well, to paraphrase the crew in the boat in Jaws, it sounds like you're going to need a bigger book.
Well, I'd be very happy to move on to another subject, but hopefully we'll still get a few more chances to talk about this.
All right. OK, listen, thanks a million, Andrew. We leave it there. All the best.
No worries. You're welcome.
And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back next week with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or you can contact me on Twitter @colmomongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. Nice reviews are even more welcome. Thanks for listening.